This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to PTBN's NBA Team Podcast. We are finally, and keyword here, finally, at the summit, the NBA Finals of 2015. I am your co-host, Andrew Reich, and I am joined by my co-host, Adam Murray. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing good. You know, I don't know why we even bothered having the playoffs, since we expected these two teams anyways.
Can you? What's more surprising, that these two teams got in the finals, or that you and I got through the season?
I'm kind of surprised we didn't make the season. I figured, Chris, okay, we're done. We did 5 episodes. We're good. We did 10.
Yeah, like it was going to turn monthly and then bi-monthly and then gone.
Here's our yearly wrap-up. We'll see you next year.
Well, I mean, I don't want to tease the listeners too much for those, you know, the 5 or 6 people that actually listen to us on a weekly basis. If you are listening, thank you for joining in. We do see the numbers. We notice that everybody is, tuning in more and more as the playoffs have gone along. Thank you for listening. But we do have a lot more things on tap even after finals end. So even though we do have some shows that kind of go into a bit of a freeze, you know, once their seasons are ending, we're going to keep on chugging. So please listen in. Don't skip a week. We're going to have as much content as possible, even when the NBA Finals ends and even after free agency and the draft ends. So definitely tune in to Place to Be Nation. There's going to be more to do there. But we are focusing on, you know, finality, because we're finally here, Adam.
It's been long enough.
It's been long enough? You feel like it's too long these days? Or, well, it's always 82 games, you know?
Especially with how bad these conference finals were.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, finally they're over. Now we can get to some decent basketball, hopefully.
Well, would you honestly call the Western Conference Finals a bad conference finals, even though it looked one-sided for the first 3 games?
It looked one-sided for the entire, you know, it was just Houston stole one, and as expected. And then all of a sudden, oh, well, we'll try to come back for 3 minutes. Nope, Golden State's going to still play. Okay, well, we tried.
While we're on topic there with the Houston Rockets, obviously they got eliminated by the Golden State Warriors. Congratulations to the Warriors for winning the Western Conference Championship. We're going to talk ad nauseum about them in a second. But let's talk about Houston for a little bit. They started out the series, first 2 games pretty tight. Game 3 got the doors blown off in Houston. Steph Curry was amazing. The whole Warriors team was amazing. They beat the Rockets by 35. Game 4 was a saver for them. James Harden went off. And people started thinking that because the last time they were down 3-1, that they came back and beat the Clippers in a historical comeback. So people were sort of looking at it saying, maybe the Rockets could pull this off, even though coming back from 3-0 is impossible. But at least in the NBA it is. But James Harden did his damnedest, had 45 points, and then what happened to him in Game 5?
He didn't have anything left. You had, you know, it was fiercely contested, you know, with that vicious knee by Trevor Ariza, and, you know, they were trying, and it was just they had nothing. The better team, Golden State showed why they were the better team. Houston showed how they were flawed, trying to rely on Josh Smith and Ariza for the end, and they just didn't have it.
And the lack of the point guard because of Patrick Beverley's injury, you know, they got to a point where they had to actually rely on Nick Johnson, who is like about as raw of a guard at an NBA level as you could possibly have right now, trying to guard Steph Curry and trying to handle the ball, because James Harden was just doing – he was just giving the ball away so many times. I think he had 13 turnovers. It was like I think that's the second time that Harden has had 12 turnovers or more in a series clinching playoff game, which is,
I think, ridiculous. That's a playoff record, if I'm not mistaken.
So I mean, what does that say though about Harden? I mean, can you say that he tried his hardest, or can you really criticize him for that?
I could criticize him the way I've been criticizing Westbrook the entire time. You can score 40 points all you want, but if you're giving up 10 turnovers, it could be an easy 20 points you just gave back. So you can't try to will your team in by trying to be everything yourself. I mean, you're playing with a champion with Dwight Howard, right?
he says he's still a champion, yeah.
Yeah, he's a champion. He said so.
You know what's weird about Harden and Dwight is this, and I feel, you know, I think they're in opposites in sort of my point of view of the two. With James Harden, I like him as a person, even though I never met the man. I think as a personality, I think he's a likable person. I hate his game. I think his game is very streamlined. It's very it's a kind of game that could be really great if he blossomed and tried to improve in certain and all the skills he could apply himself to. Instead, he just tries to do three or four things that he's great at, and he exploits it. And I think he kind of goes too far with it. You know, that's why I tried to compare him to Iverson, you know, in the previous episode. I feel like he's got sort of like – he's got tunnel vision as a guard, and I can't stand that.
The old, I am who I am. I've learned these traits. I'm going to do them. I've given up trying to play defense. I can't.
If you can be an all-star that averages 25 points a game doing that, good for you. But it's not going to win you NBA championships. Dwight Howard, I love his game. The shot blocking, he was great in game 5. You know, with the rebounding, the defensive presence, I thought he was terrific. I've always liked Dwight Howard, you know, as a player, you know. I hate him as a person. I don't think a lot of people do, you know? It's weird.
Yeah, he sort of doesn't have a nice, you know, his personality.
He shouldn't have played in game 5 anyway. He basically punched Andrew Bogut in the face, you know?
Yeah, he, you know, getting all these technicals left and right. And, you know, it's just with him, it was, I think it's just too much Dwight Howard because we had the Dwight Howard saga going to L.A., and you know, with the years of Orlando, it wasn't just one, you know, like a couple months here. It was literally years with Orlando.
Well, some radio guy asked, "Well, when did we start hating Dwight Howard?" I'm like, "Dude, you don't remember Orlando? Like when he got his coach fired, got his GM fired, and then asked to be traded like a jerk."
Yeah. Then the same thing happened with LA because it's like, "Well, I can't play with Kobe." Well, yeah, we could have told you that. So it's just the same thing of like we're tired of hearing about you. You're better just being quiet, doing your thing. But, you know, he played, and obviously he was there because, like we had mentioned, he took half the season off due to injuries, and obviously he's a little more fresher than everyone else.
A few things I noticed about the Rockets. Number one, insanely tall, athletic team. You know, when they're out in the open with guys like Brewer, Josh Smith, two guys that they added before we did our season previews. So, you know, they strengthened their team as the season went along. Even a guy like KJ McDaniels, who barely got any blow, Clint Capella, who doesn't even know how to play the game of basketball yet, it seems to me. You know, just great athletes all over the floor and just a really fun up and down team, you know, when they're at their best, when they're clicking on all cylinders. Will they be back? I'm not sure. They had a few things go their way this season with the Spurs slipping at the end of the regular season to go all the way to the sixth seed or seventh seed or wherever they went, and also the Clippers being their second-round opponent, a team that was more mentally prone to collapsing than the Spurs would have been. So they had a few things bounce their way, but they still fell to a really great team. Now let's flip it over to the Atlanta Hawks. I don't think anyone's throwing roses at the feet of Atlanta right now, even though they did have a great regular season. The best that they've had in quite a long time. Got to the conference finals for the first time as the Atlanta Hawks. You know, they did as the St. Louis Hawks way back when. But, you know, they pushed some milestones as a team this year, but it wasn't close enough. So why they got to where they were and why they lost, I felt like were two different things. Whereas with Houston, I felt like it was the same thing.
No, I think Atlanta was the same thing. They got to where they were because they were just shooting threes.
But you
got to
consider the injuries, though, which forced them to play differently.
Well, yeah, but that was the problem was, in the end, they were still trying to shoot threes, even though, due to injuries, you can no longer do that.
Mm-hmm.
They shot, like, what, game 4, they shot, like, 30 or 35 threes and hit,
well,
like,
10%. Well, they were down 15 at the beginning of the game.
Yeah, but the thing is, you're just, you know, the older you live by the three, then you die by the three. They just said, well, we're just going to keep shooting threes. Mm-hmm. We don't know how to play anything else. We're not going to even try to be a slowdown, you know, ground and pound team. We're just going to still chuck it up. So mm-hmm. I think the reason they got in was the reason they lost. They couldn't make the necessary changes
Of
injuries.
Lack of inside presence and rebounding. We said that from the beginning with the Hawks. I mean, now the Miami Heat got away with it for a long time, being a they were like dead last in rebounding and offensive rebounding for like 3 years straight. But you have LeBron James, and you have Dwayne Wade, and you have Chris Bosh. You can get around those things. The Atlanta Hawks couldn't.
Well, here's a question. I don't even know if you know the answer. Did they pick up a 15th man at the deadline? Because they traded away
Adrian Payne
to open up a roster spot. Did they actually use it for somebody?
I want to say no. You know, I think what they did is they activated Mike Muscala, who had barely played.
So that's what that was the great, you know. Again, they had this seemed like an opportunity to add a big body.
Mm-hmm.
And you just know we'll just keep it up.
People were criticizing the Clippers with the same thing, that at the trade deadline they didn't make the move.
Because they didn't have the pieces to make the moves.
Yeah.
They have no assets.
But you still did make a move, though, while all these teams like the Rockets did.
The Rockets got lucky. And to give them the credit, if they didn't trade for Brewer early on and get Josh Smith, they wouldn't have gone as far as they did. They probably would have been out in the first round. Mm-hmm. So much credit to that. But the Lakers had anybody wants. There's nobody that they have no pen. Nobody wants Spencer Hawes. Nobody wants Austin Rivers.
Well, that was their move, if you come to think of it. It was a throwaway move, but, you know.
They did all their moves by trying to get under the cap by giving Milwaukee a first to dump off two bodies.
Mm-hmm.
They have no assets to give. That was their problem was, you know, well, they didn't make a deal. Who do you want from the Clippers? Who's worth it that they're not going to, you know, you're not going to get any of the starting five.
Yeah, and Doc was forced to have to try to bolster the bench by making those guys play harder in the postseason, which is very, very risky.
You know? You know, and especially, the first-round pick was for Doc Rivers, so they don't have that. They don't have it in 2 years,
They traded away Reggie Bullock. They barely played C.J. Wilcox, you know.
Yeah, so they didn't have people to give. So, you know, they might have tried, but it's like, oh, thanks for calling. We'll call you if we need you. Click.
Yeah, we'll talk about with the Hawks and the Rockets what they need in the future. As time goes by, we'll probably key on that in another episode. But you know, we wanted to say salutations to the Houston Rockets and the Atlanta Hawks. They did what they could. Great years. I think those were the best seasons that those two respective franchises had. And what would you say over a decade and a half?
Well, that has to be for Atlanta. It has to be many decades because they haven't done anything.
The last time for the Rockets was 97 when they had Drexler, Barkley, and Olajuwon, and they lost to the Jazz when Stockton hit the three.
Well, the Rockets are just used to disappointment because every year, this is our championship year. We got McGrady and Yao and up.
Yeah, but then they got their hopes up with that comeback, and now you're thinking, oh, we're Clutch City again.
Yeah, so they're used to disappointment. Atlanta's just like, well, we're used to being the 5 seed and being out in the first round.
Mm-hmm. And now we are moving on to the NBA Finals, which begins the same way that it was announced in the first place, even though rumors were they were trying to move it up to June 2nd on a Tuesday because of the fact that they were going to be anticipating these Western Conference and Eastern Conference Finals ending so early, but they weren't able to do it. So they're going to stay on Thursday, June the 4th, as they had announced all along and scheduled on all their advertisements. And it's going to be the Golden State Warriors versus the Cleveland Cavaliers. It feels dirty just saying that. But let's start with the best team in the NBA. Would you even say arguably?
No, they were the best team. They were number one.
Let's try to keep it basic to start. Why are the Golden State Warriors in the NBA Finals?
Because they're the most complete team in the NBA, number one. Number two, they've been the luckiest team in the NBA because none of their starting five have had any major injuries.
You know, I was thinking the same thing, and I even wrote it in my notes. I said, when is the other shoe going to drop on Golden State health-wise? And then the moment I had written that, or maybe like a couple hours before that, I was watching Game 4, and Steph Curry takes a hard fall. Twitter goes crazy about it, thinking that he's hurt his wrist, hurt his shoulder, got a concussion. And then by the end of the game, he was back. And then in Game 5, Klay takes the hit. He was diagnosed with a concussion after the fact. He's out indefinitely, which means he's out for probably a day before the actual finals begins. Is that what that means?
He'll be back
for game one.
Game one, yeah.
So that was the shoe that dropped, that they got these very slightly scary but not too impactful injuries during the Western Conference Finals, but they survived it anyway.
Yeah. So that's why they're the best team, because Bogut has been mysteriously healthy all year, which has never happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest of the team has, you know, averted disaster. So,
well, you know, these great all-time teams, you know, I mean, we can go all the way from the beginning, you know, like 72 Lakers and the 86 Celtics and the 96 Bulls, all these teams that won 66 games or more, and they had a home record of like 3 losses or less. All these teams do need a lot of luck. If you look at that season in total, how many injuries did any of those teams go through? Probably not a lot. They probably had a little bit of luck go their way, too. They needed some teams that they were up against to kind of fall apart against them, feel intimidated when they played against them. And I feel like with the Warriors, that they did intimidate some teams. I think the difference, though, is that most of the teams that we were familiar with, that we consider like these great all-time teams, they had great defenses. The Warriors have an elite defense in terms of, like, the numbers, but are they, like, an intimidating type of defense to you?
No, not in the least. They're just they're a feisty defense.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Why do teams shoot 28% from the three-point line against them, which is a dearth?
Because, you know, they're just always in motion. They're always running, and you have a smaller big guy in Draymond Green who can cover the big guys, so you're working a little bit more and your shots are a little more panicked. And you know, the easy way to counter that, get some easy twos, but nobody wants to do that in the league anymore.
Yeah,
settle for nice 15-foot jumpers. No, we can't do that. We only need threes or dunks.
Steph Curry, you've heard of him, right?
I've seen his press conferences with his daughter, so I assume he plays on the team.
Well, somebody mentioned that they should hire Riley Curry, the Steph's daughter, as the head coach of the Pelicans, because that guarantees that Steph would play there. That wouldn't be a terrible idea, actually. It'd be like Kindergarten Cop kind of thing before, or what was it, Rookie of the Year? But he was like 9 years old, right?
Oh yeah,
Was it Little Big League? Little Big League was the one where he was the manager. Rookie of the Year, he was a pitcher.
He was a pitcher for the Twins in that one, yeah.
So he was a pitcher for the Cubs. Little Cubs. Big League, he was like a manager for the Twins.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm trying – I don't know. We're just getting off track. Yeah, Riley Curry is not going to be the head coach of the Pelicans. I'm very sorry, New Orleans fans. But is Steph Curry sort of like a transcendent guard to you? Like, I mean, he's a do-it-all guard, a bit of a hybrid, but is he the kind of guard where you watch him and you say, okay, not only is he – it's weird. Let me try to explain it. I can't consider him like the next evolution of the guard spot because there's no one like him, and I feel like there won't be anyone else like him.
So in that way, this is sort of more apt towards your Iverson comparison.
Yeah, like kind of like an anomaly, you mean?
You're watching him, it's like, there's nobody. I can't compare him to anybody, and there will be no one like him.
Yeah, I kind of made that one last episode with, you know, Pete Maravich and Reggie Miller, but those are very different guards.
Well, that's just we need a mesh. Yes. It would be like, okay, Pete Maravich would be the closest, mm-hmm. but you're in your own sort of by yourself. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen when he has the ball in his hands? Nobody knows.
Is he playing differently in the postseason compared to what you saw in the regular season?
No, not really. I don't see it.
I mean, is it kind of like Larry Bird when he was with the Celtics, where he plays the same way all the time, regardless of whether it's beginning of the season?
He plays the same way. It's just a little more intense after the fact. Like, you know, Bird would do it, like he would just be nonchalant and doing it during the regular season. But in the postseason, he's letting you know he's still doing it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As I see the same thing with Curry. It's like, okay, he's just going at like maybe 5% faster than he was.
Well, I feel like he's a transcendent guard because unlike Kobe Bryant, who won those 5 rings, you know, he could facilitate, but he would rather not. You know, he was more of a shooting guard. You know, he famously went like six for 24 or 4 for 24 in game 7 of the NBA Finals back in 2010. I don't think Steph Curry would do that. Like, I think Steph is a guy where if it came down to nitty gritty, if a pass is better than a shot, he will pass the ball.
I don't think he cares about stats. That's the thing. It's just, oh, I have a great 3-point shooter in Thompson. Okay, I'll just dish the ball to him.
And there are some guards that didn't really care about stats when they won a ring, but they weren't the best player on their team. That's where the key difference is.
Oh, yeah, that's where he's sort of by himself in, you know, like Maravich was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
He just happened to score loads of buckets.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you could tell Harden, he's trying for the stat board. Westbrook, he's trying for the stat board. Mm-hmm. Curry's just like, yeah, I'm playing, whatever. Whoever gets the ball gets it.
Yeah.
I get 20 assists, I get 20 assists. I get 40 points, I get 40 points.
No team with 65 wins or more who has reached the NBA Finals has lost, ever. Is there like a reason behind that other than the fact that they're just a great team and they're riding a lot of momentum because they pushed all the way through the Western Conference or the Eastern Conference?
Well, they're pushing through the conference, but also, you know, that stat is slowly becoming outdated because back then, you know, how many teams were really 65 games?
Yeah.
And now it's just the entire East where they just – every team plowed through. You know, look how every team in the West had abnormally high win records.
Yeah, but what's weird about it, though, when I was looking up that stat is that there's a bunch of 64 and 63 win teams that got to the finals and lost. Now, I will say, as a, you know, that there were some teams that got 65 wins or more and didn't make the finals, like the 2009 Cavaliers, infamously the 2007 Dallas Mavericks. There's a few of them like that, but the ones that I'm thinking about that got that far and won it all, like the 1987 Lakers, the Showtime Lakers, the yeah. Bulls did it actually a handful of times in the 90s, and the Lakers did it in 2000, and I believe one of them was the Miami Heat. I think they won 66 games in 2013. It's just one of those situations where they are clearly the best team in the NBA, and I don't want to say it's not even close because they had to go through a really tough Western Conference, but I just can't imagine even the next best Western Conference team at their very best. I don't know if they couldn't have beaten Golden State.
Well, we'll never know. I was always championing for the Clippers, saying they could have been that one team. But
I think they would have given them trouble. Like, I don't know if they could have gotten them to seven games.
I don't know. That would have been a much better series, to say the least. But, you know, they crumbled. So, you know, obviously, we all knew Golden State would be here in the end. We all picked them from, you know, the preseason.
Well, let me ask you that. What was the turning point for the Golden State Warriors? It was when they hired Steve Kerr?
No, because the team wasn't really far behind with Mark Jackson. Mm-hmm. They didn't, you know, Steve Kerr didn't inherit this.
But the team is clearly different from when Mark Jackson coached them.
The team's different, but it's the same team. You didn't have, you know, to trade for a superstar. You didn't have to. All it is just put a little couple ancillary bench people around them. Mm-hmm. It's the same team who responded to coaching before. It wasn't a toxic situation with the team. It wasn't a fatal flaw with the team.
I think Steve Kerr, first of all, had two great assistants in Alvin Gentry on the offensive end, Ron Adams on the defensive end. Also, he freed up Golden State's best players, which were, let's be serious here, Curry, then Klay Thompson, who's had a great year, and Draymond Green, who you mentioned, and basically freed them up and said, okay, we're going to centralize the offense and the defense around you guys, and we're going to protect you with interior with a lot of interior rebounding to try to protect you from getting blown by.
Well, that's the thing, is sort of Jackson, I think, left the blueprint, and then Curtis came in and be like, okay, let's just – because, you know, Jackson was the one who pretty much essentially discovered Draymond Green. Mm-hmm. And he really flourished under Jackson. Said, okay, now I know what you can do. I'll plug you in here. Let's build around you. And, you know, he just came in and sort of, wrapped it up, put the icing on the cake.
Is this – I know Draymond Green's free agency coming up. We'll talk about that another day. Do you feel like this is a team who's got a foundation in which you can build multiple title runs after this? Or is this a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing?
I think all teams these days are once in a lifetime things.
That the journey is all culminated in one season, then you start over.
Yeah, because you can say, you know, Miami won it three times in a row, or they won it twice in 3 years or whatever. But at the same time, you know, another, you know, that was it. It was just a quick. You don't have that 10-year dynasty you have anymore. Mm-hmm. So, do they have a nice core? Yes, but that's a very small core. You got, you know, it's still a big man's league. Even though it's becoming threes, you still need inside presence in there. You can't have 10 years with having, you know, Bogut, who has to be getting up there. He has to be 30 now.
Go ahead.
And I'm just saying, with the lack of big men, how much, you know, you can't – the NBA is ever-changing. That formula, this formula of just small ball threes, less fast and run a gun, that's going to work for a while, then it'll change back to slow pace, as it always does.
But will it? I mean, I'm starting to think it won't, because the NBA prefers it playing fast.
NBA prefers playing fast, but it's just cyclical. You find what stops it, then everybody goes to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody can stop the Wildcat. Everybody's doing the Wildcat. Oh, well, we figured it out. Yeah. Okay, now nobody's doing the Wildcat.
But what happens is you got to take a phenomenon and turn it into a culture. You know, like Shaquille O'Neal comes in. Okay, we all need big men because Shaq's too good. You know, and that's what happened. But the phenomenon – what is the phenomenon that's going to create that change from the fast-paced set and the three – and the, you know, the three-point line, the mid-range being abandoned? You know, Kobe Bryant made a mention about that. He said the mid-range game will come back. You know, and I don't know if that's true, but sooner or later, somebody's going to exploit that space in the middle and feast on it. And then it maybe – you know what I think it might be, Adam? It might be a center who can make mid-range jump shots.
Well, I was just going to say, like, for one, Carmelo has carved his career off that.
Mm-hmm.
Name a better mid-range shooter than Carmelo. Dirk used to be that before he said, I'm going to keep going
there
to threes.
There was one point in Miami where LeBron was.
But yeah, those two guys were doing it. And if you get, let's say, like another LeBron, a 6'8" dominant guy who can knock down the, everybody wants that then. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be changing. And what's going to happen if, you know, the Dante Exum, the 6'6" point guard thing starts taking
Michael
off?
Michael Carter Williams type of stuff.
Yeah, we need big point guards. You know, then, well, what are you going to do with Tiny Curry? It's the league is always changing. They'll find an answer to this, and then it'll move on. That's why I'm saying dynasties. You won't see us take a couple of years, but in the NBA, who knows? It just takes one injury for you to be now out of the playoffs. Look at Oklahoma City.
Yeah. What's the fascination here with Curry? Is it that – unlike LeBron, who's got this incredible athletic skills and this strength and the size that kids will never be able to emulate unless they're just born freaks of nature, is it because Steph Curry is small, he's slender, he basically does things that any other guy or girl can do on the court, the dribbling, the shooting, the skills. He obviously does it better than anyone else on the planet, but is he more accessible as a player? Is that what makes him more of a more of an approachable personality?
Well, for one, it's always that underdog thing, being the undersized point guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always have that.
But he's a dominant undersized point guard. That's the crazy part. That's what we haven't seen before.
Yeah, well, but I'm saying that's what, you know, endears him, is he does have that, you know, in the land of 7-foot giants, here he's just, you know, weaving through the trees. And also number two is he's not calling himself a champion after a semi-conference final loss.
You're really going after Dwight Howard, dude.
You know, in this me culture, have you heard him say really anything stupid or anything sort of self-centered?
You're talking about Steph.
Yes.
No. And I was watching an E60 segment that they did on him a year ago about, you know, his father, Dell, and his mom and his wife and his one kid. And it just seems like he's a very – I mean, it's obviously they're doing it for the camera sometimes, but it does seem like he's a very approachable
– just a humble, chill dude.
Yes. You know, with LeBron, I mean, I hate to pick on him, but sometimes it feels like he's pretending to be a nice guy. You
well,
know.
LeBron is just like, well, what are my analysts telling me? How am
I
trying?
I would never call him
trend nicer. Okay, I could be nicer. I could be 10% nicer. How's that doing?
I would never call LeBron a punk or a thug. Like, I would never go that far. You know, he's not a Rasheed Wallace. You know, I feel like LeBron is a nice guy. If you, you know, came up to him, I feel like he would do everything that you would ask him to do, as, you know, to reach out to kids and all that. And he does it all the time. But with Curry, maybe it's because the accessibility as a smaller guy that people can kind of like relate to, because he kind of looks like you, or he plays like you.
Well, it's just, I think with that is also, you know, that's, you know, people, all the NBA guys, they all go out to the hospitals, and that's a great thing, and, you know, that's what they should do. That's what you should do as like a role model, is go, you know, but it seems like, you know, it seems with Curry, he's not doing it for the cameras or sending out press releases, or he's not doing it for the credit. He's just out there doing it. like being a genuinely nice guy.
The post-Jordan era, I don't want to talk about the 96, 97, 98 Bulls. Those teams were amazing. Now, you can make an argument of how well some of those older teams would have done against teams today who are stronger and faster. I don't want to get into that argument today because I feel like we could talk about that for forever and we would never get a true answer. But let's talk about after Jordan leaves. You know, and it starts in after the 1999 lockout. And we look at all the teams. I wanted to bring up the main elite ones, the ones, if you look at their complete record from beginning to end, that theirs really stands out above most of the others. The Spurs in 1999 with the lockout Jordan season, even though it was a weak year in terms of depth in the league, they dominated the whole year. They lost, I think, two games in the conference finals and the NBA finals. Shaq and Kobe, this is weird. In 2000, they had a 67-win season, but they had a handful of losses in the playoffs. They had to go seven games against the Blazers. They had to go five games against the Kings when it was best of five. And they lost one to the Suns, and they went six games against the Pacers. So they took a bunch of losses to figure out how to win a championship. 2001 was weird because they struggled in the regular season due to injuries and other things, but they destroyed in the postseason. They lost only one game. The 2002 Kings didn't make the title. They didn't get to the finals, but they were about as close as you could get to a great team that didn't win at all. Your 2008 Celtics, great team defensively, incredibly talented, but they had to go seven games in the playoffs twice. You know, and then there's the 2009 Lakers. Would you kind of lump them in there too? That was a really great team.
Yeah, but at the same point, you know, it comes down to, you mentioned two teams, the Lakers and the Kings. One won the title, one didn't. Mm-hmm. You could plow through the entire postseason, win every game. If you don't win the championship, nobody's going to care about you.
So my Kings one is already mooted. It's already
exactly
gone. Okay,
that's like, you know, the 17-0 Patriots went all the way to Super Bowl, yeah, but they didn't win, so therefore nobody cares about them.
So they can't be the greatest team of all time.
If they win, you can have a discussion. You can't be the greatest team who didn't win.
Okay, the 2014 Spurs, 62-20, best record in the NBA, just pilfered through the Miami Heat in the NBA Finals, who they had lost to in the previous year. The Miami team that had beaten the Spurs in that Finals that I just talked about in 2013, that was a really good team too. Where if the Golden State Warriors win the NBA Finals, where would you put them? Would you put them above all of these teams?
They would be up there, up the top. I don't know if they'd be number one or not. But
like, would they be better than Shaq and Kobe's Lakers? Because that, to me, is like the pinnacle of this era.
Well, it depends what season.
Can I cheat and merge 2000-2001?
See, now you're just combining. You know, so that's the thing, is now you're comparing four rings to one. To let's throw in, you know, a couple, you know, here.
Yeah. If I could take the regular season of 2000 and add to it the 2001 postseason with the Lakers, you can't touch that. 67 wins, one loss in the postseason.
Oh, man, if I could take all the 1960s Celtics and then just throw in that game seven where
post,
they won.
Post-Jordan era, I say. You know, I'm not talking about the Bulls. The Bulls of the 90s were amazing. Those Rockets teams were amazing that won the title, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. But you're combining multiple seasons. You have to break it down, which I'm like, I can't break it down that fast all the time. I am like, they'd be up there for a single season, but now you're comparing them, you know, because obviously everyone remembers the two Houston wins as opposed to, well, which one really was better?
Which one, you mean?
Which Rockets win?
95, because their offense was better, and they had to play better competition. I felt like in 94, they dodged a few bullets.
Yeah, but you're just combining them both in the end. Like, oh, yeah, the Houston was dominant. Mm-hmm. Now you're breaking apart. Well, one was kind of lucky.
Uh-huh.
That's why I'm saying you can't compare one win, if they get to it, to...
Okay, 2001 Lakers, because their postseason was so dominant.
Okay, very...
But 99 Spurs were pretty great. You know, that was when David Robinson was still an all-star, and Tim Duncan was probably already the best power forward in the NBA. And how about this? You want to pine for your Celtics? 2008 one?
They were a good team. Not the best team.
But they got better as opposed to went along.
They got better, just that gritty, grittiness.
I hate to pick on the Spurs, but if last year's Spurs team played this Warriors team, the Warriors team would win.
I don't know. Last year's Spurs were on that weird revenge mission.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those. That was just a different, that was just a, okay, we have a checklist to go off now. Yeah. We're just taking, we've taken our names and now we're comeback tour.
And 2013, that was LeBron's best team. I still think it was. So what about that one?
Well, that was just LeBron's best year and everybody was healthy.
Mm-hmm. 2020 what game winning streak? Like 6? 26?
There was something up there.
Yeah. But when we're comparing these teams to this team, you know where we're going with this. We're saying that this team is unstoppable. Are we building too much out of them?
It depends if they win. If they win, everything is justified. If they lose, well, hey, they're just another one of those teams that had a great regular season run, made to the finals, and then got squashed.
If they win. And if they win, they would have to beat the Cleveland Cavaliers. So let's move on over to the Eastern Conference. The first thing I want to say about Cleveland is that we are so awash over, LeBron and Curry and the Golden State Warriors and how the Clippers choked and all these other storylines. Have we forgotten the fact that the Cleveland Cavaliers only lost 2 games in the Eastern Conference playoffs?
They did play Boston and Atlanta.
I understand that. And maybe that argument that people had said from the beginning of the season about the Eastern Conference being weak, it kind of came back to roost at the end of the season because Cleveland sort of mowed through the teams that they played against, with the exception of Chicago, because Chicago did give them a push.
Chicago, they did not mow through. Chicago, each of those games were very hard fought.
Yeah, I mean, they were a jump shot from LeBron James away from being down 3-1.
Exactly. So it was, that was basically the matchup everyone was looking for. That was, we knew Chicago, we said it even in the regular season. Whoever got out of Chicago, Cleveland would easily win. And then they did.
You said something to me earlier today that fascinated me about LeBron, where he is at as a position player. And I want you to elaborate, and I want to start with this question, is that he got to the NBA Finals with Cleveland in 2007. They got swept mercilessly by the Spurs. It almost felt like they were lucky. They were happy to even be there. What is different for LeBron? I mean, he obviously went through his phase with Miami. Let's just skip that whole process. Let's just look at the Cleveland side of things. What is the difference between the LeBron James that we saw in 2007 when he made the Finals and the LeBron James that we see now as he enters his 6th NBA Finals?
There's 2 things. 1, mileage. He has a lot more mileage on him than he did the first time. And 2, if you're looking for comparisons, the first time through, he kind of was like Harden. Mm-hmm. He was trying to will everybody to do everything.
And takeover mode.
He was the point guard, the point forward the entire time, and he tried to put the team on his shoulders and didn't know what to do. Because it's just, I have this massive talent. I'm going to win the games by myself. And, we could talk, we're just going to sit in Miami. He became a lot wiser in Miami. And as we've seen in these playoffs, maybe it's just because he's getting a little older. Hairline's sort of going backwards. But, he doesn't have those ups he did the first time we saw him in Cleveland. So he's slowly becoming this, I'm becoming a stretch 4 almost.
So you say he's more of a power forward now than he ever was.
More than he ever was. You see him backing other people down, which you never used to see.
But let me tell you this. That is something that the NBA talking heads and the really smart NBA, writers, or the coaches even, those are the ones that are scared to death of hearing something like that you just said. Because everybody has always said, once LeBron James learns how to be a great post player and he starts living in the post on smaller guys – he's going to destroy people. Is that kind of what he did in the Eastern Conference playoffs?
That's kind of what he did, and to an extent, that's kind of how he's going to maybe extend his career a little bit longer.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to ask this before you get over. Were you fascinated by how he was able to control and facilitate the offense from the post, even with a guy like Kyrie Irving as a point man? I thought that was crazy.
I wasn't fascinated. I knew for that team to work, eventually it was going to happen. Because as good as Kyrie is, you can't not have the ball go through LeBron. And by sort of settling him down there, you're now not having people sort of undefined areas.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, LeBron will just be wandering around wherever he wants. Because he can be anywhere on the court he wants to. Nobody's stopping him. So where does everyone else go? Well, we sort of will scrunch over here on this side. We're going to wait for a three. They didn't have positions almost.
I mean, you're seeing offensive efficiency from players that, I mean, had never even seen, even remotely touched those type of efficiency numbers in their careers. Guys like J.R. Smith, guys like Matthew Dellavedova, everybody's new best friend. Tristan Thompson, great offensive rebounder. He was a good one before LeBron got there, but now it's amplified by the fact that LeBron demands so many double teams when he's in the post that it's hard to be able to guide Tristan Thompson away from the ball if he just goes out and gets it.
Pretty much. And, you know, basically what you could, what I'm kind of taking away from this is from the Kevin Love injury is he's sort of being how Kevin Love was in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Being that facilitator from the center. And, you know, with Love out, you could bring in that Shumpert 3-and-D. You now have Josh Smith. You don't need to choose between the two.
So you're saying we saw pretty much an entire series in which LeBron played with Love and Irving when they were still healthy. LeBron was still playing the way that we're watching now.
Yeah, he was, but you needed that, you know, that Josh Smith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have to have more minutes on the bench then. The Shumpert to shut down somebody, he had to be, because you still need, you know, you need a Mozgov in there once in a while to, you know, clear some bodies. But, you know, you could run a little smaller and faster with LeBron at the four.
What was the turning point for the Cleveland Cavaliers? Would you say it was LeBron coming home, or was it something else? Because they did have a losing record while LeBron was resting his knees, and then they made a couple of signature trades involving J.R. Smith, Iman Shumpert, and then Timothy Mozgov with the Nuggets. Like, what do you think? And also moving Dion Waiters. What was the real turning point?
Well, the real turning point was just, you know, it was a progressive season. Everyone was like, oh, well, they've built the super team. They're going to win the 70 games. It was just like, no, you saw a team who learned how to play together. LeBron is out. If LeBron is out, you know, I could just say maybe everyone else was like, okay, we know we're not going to play at 100% either because our best guy's out. We're sort of down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, well, he's out. Why should we try? And then, you know, obviously Dion Waiters getting rid of him and his, you know, I'm an all-star. I'm first team. I'm going to be out there. For somebody who's just willing to be like, yo, I'll accept my role finally as just a shooter, and you get pieces that fit the system. And, you know, they're all playing and developing with a first-year coach, first-year guys who've been with other people, you know. Because Kyrie hadn't played with really much talent. Kevin Love hadn't played with much talent.
When you're coaching LeBron, don't you automatically become a first-year coach because you kind of have to completely change the way you look at the game because of what you have on hand?
Well, exactly. You know, you don't even...
Like, when Eric Spoelstra first got LeBron, I felt like that was his first true years a head coach. Like, he had coached a couple of seasons with Miami before that, but that was like his first big boy pants wearing type of season.
Well, I'm saying you go from Shaq, you go from Lamar Odom to Shaq to now, you know, these are three different style players.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same thing, you're coming in, you got the EuroLeague system, which is just pure Princeton offense everywhere.
Lots of passing, lots of threes.
Exactly. It's just, you were going to keep passing till we get our open shot at the end, under 5 seconds. Very low scoring, very unathletic. You know,
physicality is prominent.
Physicality is prominent. Minutes are extremely limited. You know, to all of a sudden, well, here's this one freak of nature who's going to play 45 minutes every game, and here's this lightning fast point guard who's going to be playing 45 minutes. Find a way to get all this to work, as opposed to just pure platooning where everybody gets 20 minutes, good to go.
I'm going to show you, I'm going to present you some numbers in a second about the Cleveland Cavaliers since the playoffs began. But I want you to try to tell me, just from watching them, what is different? What is the difference between Cleveland when they first got into the postseason and how you see them now? What has changed? What has turned the corner for them as they go to the NBA Finals with this dominant run?
The main change was the absence of Love.
Yeah, but what did that do for them?
Addition by subtraction. It now fit everyone sort of into their minutes role. It sort of freed up. So there was a logjam there, but everybody sort of knows now I'm subbing at this one spot. Dellavedova will come in for his minutes. Schumper will come in for his minutes. Everybody sort of knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, well, let's play big here. It's less situational, more I'm coming in. I know we're going to play the same way each game.
And you know what's crazy about that? Their three-point shooting has been really good because of J.R. Smith. You know, he's shooting 40% in the postseason. Iman Shumpert's at about 36%, which is pretty good. And even Matthew Dellavedova is making a three every now and then. LeBron James is shooting about 20% from the three-point line, which gives me the thought that his outside shot is starting to abandon him a little bit.
Yeah, but how is he taking the same amount as every year?
Haven't checked that yet. But I would say it's less. I would definitely.
I haven't seen him out there taking, because in Miami, all he would do is just jack up threes. Mm-hmm. Here, he doesn't seem to be doing that. So 20%. Well, if you're not focusing on that part of your game, okay, I could buy that.
Well, this is why I think the Mozgov move was so important among the two or three trades that they made, is that with Mozgov there, even after Kevin Love got hurt, you know, him, Thompson, and then LeBron in the post helping out. And then also J.R. Smith, who crashes the boards. I think he had a 10-rebound game against the Hawks in one of those Eastern Conference Finals games. Their rebounding has improved vastly over the regular season, and their points allowed is second best in the league, or is second best in the league among the postseason teams. So, the only thing that's kind of scary about the Cavaliers is that their assist rate is very, very low, which means that they're playing a lot of hero ball.
Yeah, but again, I'm going to say fake stats. If you're playing against Boston for four games and Atlanta for four games, who just shoot threes, you think Kelly Olynyk's out-rebounding anybody? No. You know, the stats are kind of skewed to, you don't need to pass it around because you're really playing inferior teams. The only real stat you go against is the Chicago's, mm-hmm. where they actually had two big men as well.
Yeah, but do you think the assist rate being so low is a fake stat?
Did you really need to make a ton of assists against Atlanta? I didn't see a need to go pass the ball around. They were just efficiently destroying them the entire time. Why try to be like, well, it's, you know, you're doing what you're doing. Everybody, it wasn't like one person scored 50 points. Mm-hmm. Everybody was getting in on it. So do you really need a high assist if you're just already slowly dismantling them?
I know he's injured. I know he's probably going to be hobbled going into the finals. But what did you see out of Kyrie Irving in his playoff run? Like, I mean, you got to see him pretty closely with the Boston series before he got hurt. But what did you see out of Kyrie Irving in these playoffs? Like, what do you make of him as a player?
He is slowly working his way to the top of the point guard charts.
But what makes him effective? Is it the clutch outside shooting? Is it, you know, his ability to kill people off the dribble?
It's the ball handling. It's just the ball handling. It's just at, I think, at a level for as young as he is, because the shooting's there, but shooting everything? No, because we saw Jeff Teague try to play hero ball and win it that, you know, game four, which is up. No, why is he doing it? Oh, he's trying again. No, well, don't do that, please. It's just, you know, he can make people look stupid. Mm-hmm. Which, how many point guards can you say can do that these days right now?
Well, there's only one other one, and it's probably the one he's going to be playing against in the NBA Finals. So let's go ahead and get started on the team-to-team comparison between the Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavaliers. First of all, when you look at, you know, with the naked eye, these two teams, what do you see in terms of what do you see in general with the series?
Well, you see the same thing. How are you going to stop LeBron? How are you going to stop Curry and Thompson? Thompson, I think he could be easily shut down with Shumpert. You know, he'll be slowed a little bit.
Well, he's very streaky. I mean, he goes 37 points in a quarter, and then he has a couple of games where he's nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, I think if you just put one guy on him, but how are you going to stop Steph Curry?
LeBron said you can't in an interview.
Yeah, how are you going to stop LeBron?
Oh, you know what? I take that back. This is what he said in the interview. He said, the same way you stop me, you can't.
Exactly. The first team to figure out how to stop the other person, that's pretty much a champion. Because LeBron is going to keep willing himself. Cleveland is better built because they have the size and the rebounding.
Surprised you say that because everybody would probably say that the team that Bob Myers has built, you know, with Steve Kerr running it, that's the more better built team in Golden State.
It's a small team.
More athletic, though.
You can say they're athletic, but, you know, if based on that scale, if LeBron is one of the lesser athletic people on the court, that's, you know, really not light speed ahead there for, you know, a favorite.
Memphis was a team that was able to slow down Golden State a little, and that was the one series where they had to go six games. Memphis took two losses off of Golden State. They actually had a series lead at one point. And I felt, and I told you this before, I said, I feel like that was the best game plan for Golden State, but they just didn't have the horses to push it through. The thing about Cleveland is they can slow you down, but they also average 10 made threes a game.
Exactly. They can slow you down, but they also know how to speed it back up. Houston had one a month. I mean, Memphis had one gear. Cleveland, you know, okay, we'll slow you down. All right, JR, just go knock a few threes then. Okay, bam.
Yeah. Okay, LeBron, like, you go take over. Go ahead.
Exactly. So I think Cleveland has a better chance of dictating a pace as opposed to the Warriors, who don't have a pace.
Will this be Golden State's toughest challenge?
Yes.
So by consequence, it's got to go six or seven games.
I think it'll go six. Seven, I think, might be a little far-fetched.
You mean far-fetched for Cleveland to get to seven games, not win in seven games?
I think either team to get to seven. I think if we, you know, I think it'll be a... I could see, you know, a 2-2 tie, maybe. Both teams take their home games. And somebody who takes five should take six. I don't see the home, let's get to game seven.
Nah, I think, this is my opinion. Before we get to we'll get to the final predictions at the end, so let's go ahead. You know what, I'm going to table that for just a second. And we'll continue talking about, you know, the not head-to-head matchup. I doubt we'll see too many times where LeBron guards Curry. We might see some situations where Curry tries to help out on LeBron when he's on the perimeter and he tries to break a guy down off the dribble. But basically, it's going to be LeBron doing his thing, Curry doing his thing. Who, first of all, let's start with the Golden State side. Who guards Steph Curry?
Kyrie.
With a bad knee and a bad ankle.
I would rather have Shumpert on Thompson.
I agree with Shumpert and Thompson. That one I agree on. I think people are going to cringe when they hear this because he's been so Johnny on the spot with these injuries. But what about Matthew Dellavedova?
Not for 40 minutes.
Well, no, but as a help.
Also, Kyrie's had a week of rest, so we don't know how bad. You know, how bad it is after a week or... Well, actually, it's more like 2 weeks now. Mm-hmm. You know, he came back for his one game, okay, tested out. But, you know, he's had a lot of time off to rest now.
Is he kind of a poor man, Steph Curry? If that's I mean that as a compliment. But do you think Kyrie's kind of a poor man, Steph Curry?
No, I think the game's a little different. If you want to say go ahead, I'm not going to argue too hard, but I see enough of a difference to... Mm-hmm. Move him elsewhere.
But he could be enough of an impact player to kind of stymie Curry just a tad, but you know, to give enough room for LeBron to go off and exploit his matchup.
Exactly.
Okay, now we'll flip to that side. Who guards LeBron James?
It has to be Draymond Green.
Has to be Draymond Green?
Who else are you going to put on him?
Well, after the Houston series, I think Kerr will be scared to death of putting Thompson on LeBron because he doesn't want him to foul out. So that's a no. I think he can help out, but Thompson's got to avoid those reach-ins, which he's kind of prone to doing. The other guy I was thinking about is Harrison Barnes.
Harrison Barnes will get eaten alive.
Iguodala.
Step too slow.
But he can take the fouls because you don't need him.
Yeah, you don't need him, but you're going to get a lot of lazy fouls and a lot of LeBron on the line. And if you have a lot of lazy fouls, LeBron, who's sitting there resting their knee, not running up and down the court? Kyrie.
LeBron's going to get to the line anyway. The one difference with Curry and LeBron is that Curry doesn't get to the free throw line that much. LeBron does.
LeBron does, but it'll be a lot of cheap fouls getting to the line. We're like, well, you didn't need to do that.
Okay. And
you didn't need to do that.
It starts getting your big guys in foul trouble if you have
exactly.
to like back away when he penetrates. So we talked about how Golden State is smaller. They kind of divert you into playing a different style. Do you see Cleveland falling under that trap, taking the bait, if you will? You know, with LeBron, like, kind of going into his, like, Miami ISO where he starts kind of fronting a guy from the perimeter and then tries to make something happen there with the three-point shooting. Or do you see something similar to what he did with that against Atlanta, against Chicago, where he starts settling into the post, helps out Mozgov and Thompson, and they try to eat him inside?
Well, I see it as two different ways. The first way, where he's just trying to do himself, I see him trying to do that in Golden State, which is why I said Golden State should win the first two probably easily. Then he comes back to Cleveland, you'll see a different LeBron, where he's a facilitating LeBron. So I think he's going to try to do it his way first, and once that doesn't work, he'll then switch to the other guy.
So Golden State is the one team that has the luxury to switch defenders on LeBron if they feel they have to. Why do you think Draymond's the best option?
Because he's pretty much the closest thing to a shutdown deep guy they have.
Yeah, but I don't know if he's got the foot speed to keep with LeBron if he blows by him.
You mentioned Thompson has too many stupid hand fouls, which he does. Mm-hmm. Iguodala, not as fast as he used to be. Don't even talk big men. So it's one of those sort of Harrison Barnes, he's not that good.
Well, he had that one explosion in Game 5 that, you know, bailed him out when Thompson got in foul trouble. And then
yeah,
got kneed
that one
in the
explosion,
face.
But if you're the fourth or fifth best guy on the court, well, eventually you're going to have your moment, but you're still that fourth or fifth best guy. So he's not, you know, he's not a good matchup for defending LeBron.
You already talked about the freeze, live by the three, die by the three. Both of these guys live by the three, but the one thing they do is that they make their opponents die by the three because their three-point percentage defense is so good. So does this sort of prove both points at the same time? That you can live by the three and win a title, but you can die by three and lose at the same time?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing is they're just going to – I think, you know, Cleveland might buy into that. We're just, hey, you will try to – we could go 3-3 for you.
Yeah.
We could do that. Then they were like, wait a minute. We have Mozgov and – you know, I could go down there.
Yeah,
you
know. I can envision hot shooting in one game. I don't think it's going to last for an entire series for either team. These finals games get so tight when they're competitive, and everybody starts forcing shots, even the great teams. I mean, I remember I was just actually rewatching the Bulls and the Sonics in 96, and when they clinched, you know, the Bulls won, but they shot like 38%. Like, they didn't play great. Now, that was a different era. But I can see that happening in Golden State, too, where they don't throw their best fastball, but they find a way to win because defensively they're able to dig out those rebounds and get those steals and get those blocks. You know, Cleveland is sort of acclimated themselves into that style as the postseason gone along. I'm not saying – everyone is expecting this fun up-and-down series, and it might be, but I am bracing fans – with the potential that it might get ugly at times.
Oh, it might be that up in the series for the first half of the game. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, basically the first team, they can't come out too cautious. You can't go out, you know, we can't play to lose. We can't make that big mistake. Because that's how either team's going to blow it. So you'll have it up and down. Let's all trade shots. Let's see.
Feeling out.
Exactly. Then the screws will get tightened. And as the games, you know, you slowly get to game five, it'll be way more slow down that way.
And then there are games that go the opposite, where they start out tight and then it loosens up.
But no, I this one it will definitely be loose to tight.
Okay.
Because they're both teams are going
to go. Instead of tight to loose, this will be loose to tight.
Because both teams know how to shoot. So, like, let's just keep shooting. If our shots don't go down, okay, then we need to tighten up. Or, you know, let's just go out, well, you know, let's just go out no fear.
Do you feel like tightening up the Warriors is the only way to beat them?
Yes.
But the one problem with that is that if you tighten up on the Warriors, they're rebounding so good that you're not going to get enough possessions to win if you go down double digits.
Yeah, but then you just, you, well, that's why, again, with Memphis, they didn't know how to speed back up.
Mm-hmm.
Cleveland does know how to speed back up to get themselves back in. So.
We asked the question about which, that both players will probably be able to exploit their positions, but which one do you think will be able to do it better, Curry or LeBron?
Probably Curry.
And for what reason?
Because, like LeBron, you could just foul him a lot easier than Curry can. Because with Curry, you know, you lose track of him, and you're running around the court. Oh, he buries a three from the corner. Where the hell was he? I lost him. LeBron, okay, help defense foul. Help defense foul. We can slow him down.
Yeah, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
He's there.
So it could be almost sort of be like, well, let Curry beat us. Let's shut down everyone else. Let's, you know, we'll give Curry his 40, but if we shut down Klay Thompson and we shut down, you know, a hot shooting Iguodala, let's say, okay, that team becomes a lot different if you take out that, you know.
Give me one player to watch in the NBA Finals, and not necessarily one we haven't heard of, because we've heard of all these players since they've been, you know, marching all the way through the postseason with their team. But give me one player who might make an impact where you thought, that not expect.
First, I'll give you the curveball.
Okay.
The hottest player right now, Festus Ezeli.
That's not terrible. That's not like a far reach, you know. He was playing against the Rockets.
That's the thing, is he's, I think of all the players in this conference finals, he might be the hottest guy right now, and everyone, you know, well, he's not the starting five. He's not, well, who? Mm-hmm. You know.
I'm an SEC guy, so, you know, I watch all the basketball. You know, obviously, I loved Anthony Davis anyway because he was a Kentucky player, and he wound up playing for, you know, my Pelicans. But I remember only three centers in college giving Anthony Davis trouble in his one season in college. One was Cody Zeller. You know, defensively, Anthony Davis had trouble with him. The other guy was, crazily enough, was Jeff Withey for the Kansas in the national championship game. He just had trouble on offense. Defensively, he had no problem against him. The third guy was Festus Ezeli at Vanderbilt.
Yep.
What do you see in him that's been effective?
He's just been explosive. He seems to have that the honing senses out of, hey, I know where I need to be, and he's getting there before everyone else.
So basically, the want-to.
I wouldn't say the want-to. I'm just saying he has, I don't want to say that Rodman premonition where he sort of knows where to be before he's there, before he gets there.
But is a good comparison like a Carl Landry when he was with the Rockets?
Yeah, he's
kind of there wherever, he's there whenever you need him.
He's there when you need him, but he's getting his spots before you expect him to. Like, he's having that almost, like, split sixth sense. Like, I need to get here. I need to get here. I need to get here, here, here. So he's sort of playing on fire right now. That's why I said it's sort of a curveball. But the player I definitely watch is Shumpert. Because they need something from offense from him, too.
But his offense has been solid in the playoffs.
It's been solid, but if you're spending all your time trying to shut down Klay Thompson, or if they put him on Curry, you know.
But I will say, defensively, you know, Klay does have a tendency to overhelp. With offense, he does have a tendency to freeze sometimes. What makes him effective is when he does the wheel arounds and the screens and stuff, and he gets himself open for that one slither, and then he takes that quick release. That's what makes him so effective. when he starts to settle, when he starts to freeze, it might give enough time for Iman Shumpert to get his energy back and stay effective on the other side of the court.
Well, that was like, you know, all Clay needs to sort of do is the old Rip Hamilton, I'm just going to run in circles till I wear you out. Mm-hmm. You know, you can still defend me all you want, but you're now useless on the other side because you need to catch your breath. I'm just going to just run in a circle, way around the court. I know I'm not even part of the play. Nobody's even looking to pass to me, but I'm just going to keep making your run.
Okay, here's my two. One from one team, one from the other. For Cleveland, Mozgov. I mean, if he has great rebounding numbers, and I remember one game where he had like 29 rebounds against the Warriors. Now, that was like last season under Mark Jackson when he was playing for the Nuggets. So different scenario, different game. But he does have success against teams that sort of like to play fast because he's able to gobble rebounds in traffic pretty well. So if he's able to solidify himself as a solid 10-rebound-a-game guy in this finals, he's going to be an impact player for Cleveland, the likes of which I don't think people are going to be anticipating. Do you feel like Mozgov's established himself as that sort of a guy where you have to keep an eye on him? Or is he a surprise every time he plays well?
Well, no, he's a surprise because we're all talking. We're talking going 3-for-3, just, you know, while match you. We're not talking. We haven't mentioned really any inside game period.
Yeah. Well,
we just said Tristan Thompson's a great offensive rebounder, but he can't shoot for shit. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Mozgov, you know, you and I sort of sing his praises more than really a lot of people do.
Yeah, and also you can't hack him because he shoots 84% from the line.
Yeah. So he's
the only one you can hack is Tristan Thompson.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the one thing problem with the Zealy one that you picked is that he can't shoot free throws. So they might hack him. David Blatt will do it if he has to. You're desperate. It's the finals, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah. Well, I'm not gonna go for that easy pick. Who's the players to watch? I'm gonna try to find, you know, a more obscure guy. So it's just like, I'm not going to say.
And here's my obscure guy with Golden State, David Lee.
Well, if David Lee plays 15 minutes, you know they probably won because you never see him on the court anymore.
No, I feel like because they're going to – Kerr is going to probably have to adjust at some point in one of these games throughout the series, and he's going to have to play bigger, which allows Lee to get more playing time.
That you have to put Lee, you know – Lee has to go out there on Thompson at least, because you can't have Thompson.
Or at least the gobble fouls on LeBron if he starts to.
Well, let's say you go Thompson, Mozgov, and LeBron. You're not gonna go Bogut, Harrison Barnes, and.
Well, say Golden State goes on a run, and it's because LeBron was matched up with David Lee, and LeBron just happens to either turn the ball over or miss on those two assignments that Lee is assigned for. Would people say that David Lee made an impact on the game? Yes. Even though it might not be deserved, you know. And offensively, David Lee is a skilled player.
Yeah. No, he just fell out of the rotation just because of the way the team is.
Yeah.
He's still very good. It's just, you know,
all
right.
Overpaid. But, yeah.
Well, that's how they had to get him. Because don't forget about they were terrible at one time.
Well, yeah, they were the one team that offered the contract, and David Lee said, okay, I'll take it.
You know? Yeah. So if that was back when, you know, you had
that was
to
when
give
Don up. Nelson was still there, my God.
Well, Don Nelson, just look at the draft history about how things are sort of cyclical. Mm-hmm. Curry was number 7 pick, maybe? 8? You know, he was just right after the Rubio thing. Klay Thompson was the 11th pick. They had, you know, a wasted pick in between.
Then they picked Harrison Barnes and Draymond Green.
Harrison Barnes was an 8th pick. Draymond Green was a 2nd-round pick, I think 35th, right after Jay Crowder, I believe.
Yeah.
So that's some solid 2nd-round players. A lot of, you know, some teams missed on. But, you know, you have a lot of lottery picks on that team. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, wow, look at them. They're there because, well, they've drafted smart. And now, you know, they're no longer the basement. But with David Lee, that's what you have to do with bad teams. You need to overpay a guy to come there. So
a few miscellaneous notes, you know, before we start closing things out. Why are we going to be talking about Kevin Love so much?
Because ESPN is going to force it down our throat.
But what is it about Kevin Love?
It's just the storyline is the team who traded for him versus the team who didn't. What would happen if Kevin Love was in? How would the team play? What if, what if, what if?
Well, you know. But we've talked about this a bunch of times. Would they have gotten to the finals with Kevin Love instead of Klay Thompson?
We don't know because it's all what if. I think they probably would have. This would have been a different team. Mm-hmm. The way Steph Curry, you know, Steph Curry's the MVP. I'm pretty sure, you know, even not, you know, they might not have won 65, they might have won 60, but I don't see the team.
Okay, let me ask you this as a scenario. Kevin Love leaves in free agency.
What's all people talking about now?
What's that?
That's all I've been hearing from the Boston papers is, up. Kevin Love's going to leave. Kevin Love's going to leave. That's all they're reporting now. And it's just like, well, you know.
But,
and
then, well, here's the question. Will the Cavs regret making the move?
No. If they win, no, because you won the title and you do whatever's necessary to win the title. Mm-hmm. And he got you to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, without him, they probably wouldn't have been in the position they were in.
So don't think like he was horrible and it was just a wasted Andrew Bynum deal. Like, okay, we're going to try. Because it's more like everyone, you know, everyone rags on Philly for like trading for Bynum. But that was a legit attempt of, we're going to take a shot. If it fails, it fails.
We're going to try to win. Yeah.
And then it failed, and that was just on Bynum failing, not the team failing for trying to trade for him, which is why, you know, you and I have conversations about New Orleans and should they be the team who's trying to make these picks and some work, some don't. So that's the same thing. Golden State had to overpay. You know, Cleveland had to overpay. Then all we need Mozgov. So let's ship out a first-round pick for him. So if you win, well, you did what you needed to do. You always have that championship.
Well, it was also like the tenure of the deal with LeBron. It's 2 years, and they have an option this year that he's likely not going to use. But it creates the urgency. You've got to win now. I can't wait for my prime to pass. You know, and I felt like that was the urgency that kicked in for Cleveland once we got into the year 2015. And then they made all these deals, and the team was vastly better by the middle of the year than they were at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, because it was just, well, we can't rely on LeBron's friends coming in wanting to play. Mm-hmm. We need to get somebody to put a team together.
If the Warriors win the championship, where would you put the Curry-Klay Thompson kind of duo? Like, where would you put them? Like, would you put them around, like, the Bird, McHale, Shaq, Kobe?
No, because
like, it's like, just... let me put it this way. Like, when you say Golden State Warriors 2015, would you say Curry and Thompson, or would you say just Curry?
Right now, it's just Curry. Mm-hmm. Thompson, you know, like you said, he could disappear. And it's all been Steph Curry. It's all been, he's been the one who's dominating everything. So,
but that's the luxury of a sidekick. You can disappear and still win.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what's going to happen. Can you compare them to these two? No, because, again, this goes back to, you can't compare two guys for 1 year as opposed to, you know, Bird and McHale. That was a dynasty. Kobe and Shaq, dynasty. You're not just, oh, well, this was the one lone championship.
This is a two-party question, and it's about the regions. The underdog in Las Vegas is definitely going to be Cleveland. But who's the figurative underdog of the series?
The figurative underdog is still Golden State.
Is it because of LeBron?
It's because of LeBron, and people still have that image of them as a really shitty team. Some teams just have that underdog mentality, and, you know, it takes a while, but, like, yeah, weren't you just, you were an 8 seed a while ago, and you, that was it, and everyone was happy because you made the playoffs. They don't have that championship pedigree. Mm-hmm. You know, Klay Thompson and Steph Curry, they don't have that, well, they have that young and hungry versus LeBron's, well, I already have my rings. I'm veteran savvy.
But just because Golden State is the figurative underdog doesn't mean that the Cleveland Cavaliers are like the bully on the block. It feels it's weird because this feels like a finals that, you know, we talk about the era of parity. And the good thing about parity is that really good scrappy teams get a shot against one another instead of all the scrappy teams getting plucked out by the king. You know, I mean, but what were you going to say?
It's just the same as it's Jordan versus Utah. It's Jordan versus Portland.
It's Shaq and Kobe versus everybody.
You know, it's the same thing. It's, can these two kids take down LeBron? can, you know, the legendary status of the one guy, can this ragtag group of kids get together and take down the king?
But when the Spurs took down LeBron in the finals, and even when the Mavericks took down LeBron in the finals in 2011, and the Spurs was in 2014, the motif was, well, it was great team play. I don't think that's going to be the end of the story if Golden State takes down LeBron and wins the championship. It's going to be they couldn't stop Steph Curry.
It's going to be like Ric Flair. You know, in order to be the man, you have to beat the man. And if the Warriors win, like, Steph Curry's a new king.
Yeah, but we didn't say that about Dirk Nowitzki and Kawhi Leonard when they took down LeBron. Why is this different? And he's not even a small.
Because player. If you have nobody to pin it on, it's like, oh, it was great team play. The team beat him. And Kawhi Leonard, you know, as great as Kawhi was, it's still Tim Duncan's team. Tim Duncan put it out, it's like, well, that's Tim Duncan. He wanted revenge and his quiet revenge as he does. But, you know, that's just it's like the old Lil Mac versus Mike Tyson, and Steph Curry's, you know, beating Soda Popinski and Macho Man, and now he's up to the king, and now if he takes down LeBron, yes, all everyone's going to be talking about is Steph Curry.
If the Cavaliers pull it off and they defeat the Warriors, is this LeBron's greatest accomplishment?
No.
What? Winning a title for Cleveland, a pro sports championship for the first time since 1964, and beating a legitimately great team.
It wouldn't be his greatest accomplishment because he already won two titles earlier.
Well, then what would you say it is? Was it beating the Spurs?
This will be something that people won't get angry. Be like, you know what? Cleveland deserves that. Cleveland has been, you know, a good city. You know, they finally got something good for them. It's not like there's really no. I don't see any bad storylines coming from this. Whoever wins,
there's the suffering of the losing team.
There's the suffering of the losing, but there's always going to be one. But if you know the winning story for Golden State, Cleveland, you know, if they win, it's just, well, Cleveland finally got one, and good for them.
That was going to be the other part of that question I was asking. Which city? For which city is this title most important, or this opportunity Cleveland. Most important? Definitely.
Cleveland has nothing. They've never had anything. The only thing Cleveland has is abandoned buildings to be proud of. Ooh. You know, there's nothing, and maybe Bone Thugs and Harmony. You know,
all Golden State has is a bunch of earthquakes, and The Rock has to save us in a helicopter.
But they have, you know, the Oakland. They're just.
Where is San Andreas? Is that close to there? I'm not a geography major.
I have no idea where San Andreas is, but, you know, you have bridges. Go across the bridge. Well, now you're in San Francisco. Go across the bridge. Well, now you're in San Jose.
They're about to lose their team.
But you have other things. Cleveland, there's nothing nice around Cleveland. Once you leave Cleveland, you're still in Ohio. You got nothing, you know. You just have shitty weather, shitty teams. You have, you know, the Cleveland Browns.
So you're saying because you live that life in that region that championship will mean more?
To an extent. You know,
not just the suffering as the Cleveland Cavaliers fan. You know, like, that would be like saying it means more for an Ohio State fan, even though they just won a title about 12 years before, because of the fact that they live such a rigid, rough life in the Midwest. You know,
I think it's just more of like, well, look at what the Saints title did for New Orleans. It wasn't just our town one. It was like, we're no longer, you know, the laughing stock of the league. We're no longer the Aints. It lifted the city up.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, well, we won one with LSU.
Yeah.
Well, that's college. And, you know, most of college towns, you know, Alabama has nothing going for it. So all they have to hang on is college.
Yeah, that's Friday Night Lights out in Alabama.
Like, you know, even most of Texas, that's all they have is just Friday Night Lights. Is, you know, our high school team won. You know, we're gods. That's it. You're done there. So it elevates the city with just the title. It's not just the team won. It's
all right. The NBA is a copycat league. What would that say if the Golden State Warriors, with their up tempo and their three ball, what would that do to the NBA if they win the championship? Or is that something that's already been put in motion by the San Antonio Spurs winning the championship with their motion offense?
Well, it's already been put in motion with the Spurs, and then Atlanta does the same thing. And, you know, it's just funny. Steve Kerr, well, he is a disciple of the triangle, doesn't use it, goes to finals.
He actually uses a lot of Princeton, if you really look at the sets. A lot of Princeton and a lot of UCLA offense.
Yeah. So, but no, no triangle.
Actually, let's divert to that. Kerr and Blatt, can you really hammer down the styles of coaching with the two? Can you see a difference?
No.
Like, you don't see a distinct style between the two with Blatt and Kerr? Or is it just a matter of those star players dictating the pace of play?
I see it's just a matter of the star players. I don't see Blatt having much of anything right now. Mm-hmm. I just see him as a very generic, bland coach who's just more of a player-manager.
I felt the same way with Spoelstra. I feel like Spoelstra is a defensively-minded coach, and the defenses in Miami were good under LeBron, but I felt like it was square peg, round hole. I felt like LeBron was influencing what Spoelstra wanted to do, and that's no shock. Players influencing how the plays are made is kind of like normal in the NBA.
Yeah, man, all you have to do then is just make sure you pull your guys out at the right time and make sure everybody's fresh.
But it's like saying, well, you know, Larry Bird and Robert Parrish are – you know, Kevin McHale were great, but it was, you know, Casey Jones' system that got him. It was like, no. It was because they had Hall of Fame players. You work around that. I felt like Spoelstra did the same thing in Miami. I feel like a lot of the great coaches do that for their teams in order to push to a title, and this is definitely a case of both, and that's why first-year coaches are going to be playing each other in the NBA Finals for the first time since they actually had a league in the early 40s, you know?
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's like the first.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, obviously first-year coaches aren't going to have a system in place because you can have your preconceived, like the same thing being a freshman in college. I'm going to be a psych major. I'm going to do this and this and this. And all of a sudden, all right, we're just going to go with the flow.
I just described everybody's lives for the last 10 years.
You know, so it's the same thing with the coaches. I'm going to be this type of offense. And, well, once you realize your players can't do what you want to do, all right, we're just going to defer to them. All right, so now the big question. Predictions. What do you got?
I think the Warriors win in five. I think LeBron will do his damnedest to take one out of Golden State, particularly game two, but I don't think he's going to pull it off. I think Golden State will actually go up 3-0. And because of the 2-3-2 system being abandoned, I think the game five, which will be in Golden State, will be the clincher.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to say the same Golden State in six. Because it was 2-3-2, I'm like, all right, Cleveland might be game six in...
Yeah, I was kind of envisioning it like the 96 Bulls, who the Warriors have been compared to a few times, where they went 3-0 on the Sonics, and then the Sonics won two in a row because they had three games in a row at home. Then they went to Chicago, and they got pistol whipped.
You know? Yeah, I think it's going to be both teams, like I said, game up to game four, 2-2, everybody wins their home games. And then the Warriors are like, okay, now we know what we need to do in Cleveland. Let's just do our business at home and then wrap it up there.
That's gonna break, right. That's gonna break Cleveland's heart if they lose there.
Well, that's what Cleveland's just used to. So,
do you miss the 2-3-2 format?
No, thankfully it's gone.
Did you actively hate it?
Yes, there was no point for it.
I didn't hate it, but I disliked it.
There was no travel days are so useless. This isn't, you know, 1950, we have one flight across country. It's like, no, yeah, everybody has their Learjets. Everybody's doing the same thing. Like, you could do it. Just do it normally.
Is there any chance of Golden State scoring under 100 points in any of these games? I mean,
maybe
we can slow them down.
I'm going to say the final game might be below 100 because they're going to start loose and then slowly tighten up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, I'm going to say, like I said, either way, game six. You can tell me Cleveland will win. I'll be like, all right, game six. I just see it's not going to be a four-game sweep. It won't be a five-game, you know, where they got one out of it.
A gentleman's sweep, as they say.
Yeah. No, I see two hard-fought matches where they get it, and then, bam, we're six. So that's what, you know, we both agree on the Warriors.
So, yeah, all this talk was about nothing because we basically predicted everything everybody else predicted.
But we have to go over the scenarios. Just, yeah. You know, got to talk it through and –
But you know, no, I agree with you. Like, this is kind of a happy ending regardless. Like, one way or another, a franchise or a city that's been so, like, absent of a pro sports title is going to get what's coming to them. And it's great.
Look, both teams are going to have riots.
It's just the shame in the parity era that you have all these teams that are going to probably get their chances in the next 5 or 6 years. But the problem with it is that, you know, someone's going to suffer. You have to have a loser. You just hope that it's not the same team losing all the time. You don't want those Utahs. You don't want those New York Knicks teams. Like, you don't want teams that always come up short, because those are the heartbreakers. Those are the legacies that you can't run away from, even if you're a great player and a multi-time champion like LeBron James.
Yeah, but, you know, in the upcoming years, will there be future dynasties? I don't know. We have free agency we're going to talk about. We have the draft. We're not shutting down, right?
No, we're not going anywhere. I mean, everybody else is going to be closing everything up. Yeah, everybody would think that the NBA closed everything up because we had to go a week without basketball. So they're going to be watching it on Thursday like, oh, shit, we're still playing? I thought it was over. I thought LeBron and Curry both won the NBA championship. No.
Yeah. It's not wake me up when Christmas is here because basketball's back. No, we're going to be going through all the offseason.
Yes, we're going to be chugging it along like we always do. I think people are going to be fascinated and going to be intrigued by some of the ideas that we have going down the line in the summer and then going into the fall as we near basketball season again. But on behalf of Adam Murray, this is Andrew Reich. Enjoy the NBA finale.